We are creatures of desire. What we most desire is meaning. What makes us suffer most is a lack of meaning.
The Meaningful Life with Andrew G. Marshall. Marital therapist, author, and communications trainer Andrew G. Marshall invites guests from all walks of life to discuss what makes life meaningful.
Hello, I'm Andrew G. Marshall. Welcome to The Meaningful Life. We're available on Apple, Spotify, Podbeam, and wherever you find your podcasts. Do you tend to lose yourself in your relationships? Do you worry if your partner does not immediately return your calls? Do you rush to make up after a fight because you can't bear feeling disconnected? Beyond the brief falling in love stage, are the men and women in your life emotionally unavailable or perhaps untuned to your needs? My witness today is Jessica Baum, who is a psychotherapist and couple counsellor with 10 years' experience and the author of Anxiously Attached, Becoming More Secure in Life and Love. Now, Jessica, you start the book with a confession. In my young adult years, I was a train wreck when it came to dating. Tell me more.
Yeah, I think that early on in my life, you know, I struggled like many of us do. And, you know, you could label it codependency. I was hospitalized for extreme anxiety and was struggling in my relationships. And I actually thought I had a brain tumor, but it was just anxiety. And I remember picking up the book, Facing Codependency by PM Melody, and thinking, oh my God, I finally have some framework around, you know, what I'm experiencing. And of course, many years later, codependency is a word that is misused and misunderstood, although it helped me at the time. Attachment is really what we're looking at when we're looking at adaptive strategies. So it was that very beginning of just starting to identify that I'm not crazy, I'm not alone, other people struggle. This is many, many years before I got my master's degree and started studying the nature of relationships and really understanding attachment theory, because the attachment theory really explained what I was going through and helped me feel less crazy and less alone in the world and gave me a path towards healing.
So let's dive straight in and talk about attachment theory. Can you lay it out for us?
Sure. Attachment theory was discovered in 1950 by Mary Answorth and John Bowlby. And they did a lot of research around how babies attach their primary caregiver. And, you know, they discovered there are certain ways in which people adapted and attached. There's four different categories or four different patterns, really. We call them styles, but they're really adaptive patterns. They're secure. So those are babies that have internalized their parents and they feel pretty secure in the world. They can play and know that their parents are there for them. They grow up with a little bit more inherent trust in the world when they're adults. They don't have major abandonment issues and they don't have major engulfment issues. And when they do have issues, because we all have issues, they get back into what we call homeostasis faster. So they can get dysregulated and kind of come back to a sense of safety faster. And then there are three insecure types of attachment. There are anxious, the one I wrote about. There's avoidant. I actually write about both anxious and avoidant in my book because they're attracted to each other. And then there's fearful, which is scientifically called disorganized. And so anxious babies tend to lose themselves as they monitor the need of their parent. So I would say the hallmark for anxiously attached people or patterns is inconsistency. So a feeling like the ball's going to be dropped, they will be left. This is at the core of their abandonment wound. They tend to want to merge and they can overshare and give a lot in their relationships. They can lose themselves. They can be the maximizer often, which is like they expand their energy when they're scared in fight or flight. And then the other extreme is more avoidant babies. And sometimes a true avoidant baby is developed when a mother or a primary caregiver doesn't see the emotional needs of the child. She might meet their needs, but the emotional needs aren't met. So the child just basically gives up and they don't have a lot of expression in terms of connection. So they tend to focus on success and career and focusing on themselves a little more because it's very hard for them to co-regulate. It's very hard for them to depend on other people because they learned early on that kind of dependency is not available.
And I think one of the important things to say about people who are avoidantly attached is that actually deep down they do want to be attached. So you'd think avoidantly attached would never date at all because they're entirely self-contained, but that's not the case, is it? They need attachment just as badly. It's just they go about it in a slightly different way. So how could an anxious and an avoidant come together in a way that is going to drive both of them crazy?
Yeah, so I talk about this a lot in my book because a lot of people struggle with this. And the problem here is that when an anxious person is in a sympathetic activated state, so when they're scared, they struggle with self-regulation because they didn't get enough co-regulation as a child. And so they run towards the person and they want to fix and get back into connection immediately. And their abandonment issues kind of come to the surface, or just fear. And an avoidant person, when they're scared, they run away to kind of try to self-regulate and self-soothe. So the problem is really that the nervous systems are signaling fear at the same time. And one wants to typically run towards, and the other one typically wants to run away. An avoidant person can be scared of intimacy and also abandonment. Abandonment and intimacy run in both. Just an anxious person is conscious of their abandonment wound and unconscious of their intimacy wound. And an avoidant person is conscious of their intimacy issues, but unconscious of their abandonment issues. So we just basically have, you know, opposite ways of protecting, surviving, and adapting that kind of compete with each other when both partners are trying to fix a rupture or get back into connection.
So we ought to mention what the fourth one is, the fearful attachment.
Yeah, so there's fearful, or some people call it disorganized, and that's when a baby or an infant needs attachment. Remember, attachment, connection is our biological imperative. Like, we cannot live without connection. And when a primary caregiver is scary, whether they're angry or abusive, the baby still needs to reach out to survive, but they're also terrified at the same time. So they're stuck in what we call like a very disorganized state. I've actually experienced this. So attachment, you're not one style. You might have adaptive strategies that you lean towards, but you can have all these styles or embedded patterns embedded in your nervous system and inside of you. And attachment is a two-way street. So it's you plus another person's embedded patterns that make up the relational dance. So this is where a lot of people, like, they want to label themselves. They want to label their partners. But the truth is, I can be more anxious with one person. I can think of one person in my life that I struggle a lot with because she's, in my opinion, very inconsistent. And I can be more secure in other relationships, and I can be avoidant if someone is really coming at me and, you know, I can't handle it. We're not this label. That's not how interpersonal neurobiology works. We're really like a flux of many of these things.
But in general, although we can probably do all three of the different styles, in general, we have one we lean more towards. Is that, am I hearing this correctly?
Yeah, I think that in general, we adapt to fear in a particular way, usually. And so anxious people usually get bigger or want to fix, and avoidant people usually can shut down and want to run away. So that's typically, but if you push an avoidant person far enough, they will snap and react and all of that. And again, an avoidant person might not do that with someone who's really secure. You know, you just don't know when you have certain combinations and adaptive strategies that play out together.
So in your first marriage, you became hypersensitive to even micro disengagement. So tell us about that so we can sort of understand how it might manifest in a relationship.
Sure. So we have something called neuroception. So this is like, I like to think of it as invisible radar, but we're always scanning our environment for safety or threat, right? We always want to feel safe. And so if disconnect was part of our childhood or part of our pattern, we're going to look for and feel anytime our partner pulls away, withdrawals, or disconnects. And we can feel that on an energetic level. And it can awaken a very early part of us. And I think I write about that. It awakened my autonomic nervous system to the point where it was very visceral. It was very sensational inside my body. And I think anybody who's listening can maybe think of a time when their partner shut down or didn't respond, or, you know, we all go through these periods and logically we're like, okay, maybe they're just busy or they're just whatever. But our body remembers, you know, connections, and our body remembers the loss of connection. And so when anything resembles a loss of connection, and when the connection's close to us, it can awaken earlier sensations of loss of connection. And what people really don't understand is that the body keeps the score, right? And the body and the sensations that are woken up are actually memory. We store memory as sensation very early on. So I talk a lot about like my gut falling through the floor or certain sensational experiences happening in my body. And the truth is those are earlier memories. And that's a very important concept that I'm trying to get the general public to understand. You know, then we can get a little bit more out of projection and a little bit more into holding and healing those sensational experiences.
Because that is something that's really sort of hard to really take on board, that these things that happened before even our memories were there, you know, we don't actually know 100% what happened because, you know, your parents aren't going to be the most reliable of witnesses. And yet these things that we don't remember have such a huge impact on us.
Yeah, I think a lot of our implicit memory is stored subconsciously, right? And so we're storing information all the time subconsciously, more than explicit memory. And our parents can do an amazing job and love us. And if their nervous system was scared or they weren't present, or, you know, 66% of the time, they have to show up pretty well. But if they miss the mark more than that, because they're struggling with anxiety or they're going through conflict or, you know, so much intergenerational and epigenetics play in here, they really could be great. But as a little sensing being, when you're an infant and they're struggling, you're scared. And so you're picking up on a lot of information, even if they're showing up and they are meeting your needs, if they're not present enough and they're not attuning enough and they're not co-regulating enough, because in their world, they're suffering, it will later impact your world and you won't have a conscious memory of it.
So if somebody's thinking, am I anxiously attached or not, what are the things that they should be looking out for that would typically tell you that this is a pattern that they're going to be using?
Yeah, I mean, I hate to use the word, but if you identify as anything codependent, like abandoning yourself, so the baby doesn't sense that the primary caregiver is there all the time. So they end up kind of regulating the other person and attuning more. So if you're one of those people that know what your partner's feeling more than what you're feeling, and you'll meet their needs over yours and you'll self-abandon, that is, you know, a kind of indication that's a brilliant adaptive strategy that you learned early on that can kind of get you feeling resentful or disconnected or self-abandoned later in life. And so, you know, the work is to come back home and kind of work through some of that and understand that that's a brilliant adaptive strategy and there's nothing wrong with you. We just have to start to kind of unpack that, so to speak.
But it's very easy to see your partner as the problem, because if only they did A, B, C, if only they returned your calls quicker, or if only they loved you enough, then everything would be fine.
Yeah, I mean, that is very common. And then the illusion of safety is there when our partner does what we need them to do. And the second that they don't, we want to blame them. The truth is the fear and the abandonment and the pain has been there all along. And so they might have just been a great person to help us avoid it unconsciously. And then sometimes a partner is going through their own stuff and can't show up in the same way. And here our world, our inner world shifts and changes and becomes very scary. And it's very easy. I've been there to project and want your partner to change. And by all means, our partner should hopefully be willing to do the inner work as well. But if they're not, the sense of agency is that you still can, by not making this all about your partner, by understanding trauma and understanding attachment that lives in your body, and starting to bring these uncomfortable and painful experiences to someone who can actually help hold them.
So when did you start to change from being anxiously attached to, I hope these days, securely attached?
I say that I have moved a lot more towards secure attachment, but it had a lot to do with bringing in people in my life who I call anchors and are really secure supports for me, and their nervous system is consistent and pretty reliable and warm, and letting go of relationships that were incapable of meeting my emotional needs, and starting to kind of not placing blame or not getting upset, but starting to notice, like, am I recreating something that's familiar by staying in relationships that can't meet my needs? Because that is my childhood, right? Or can I start to invite warm, receptive relationships that actually will allow me to be vulnerable and connected? And so over a period of time, your system, your nervous system starts to recognize what availability, what interdependency really is, what feeling supported really is, and doing some deep work when you slow down and you start to kind of eliminate the unavailable type. So yeah, I feel like I've worked a lot more towards secure. I have to say it took a couple of years, and it actually took a relationship that the other person was pretty unavailable to wake up a lot of my parts, and he wasn't willing to do the therapy with me. So I had to bring all of that to a therapist who was really skilled, and I actually healed. I healed a lot of my attachment trauma by being awakened to all my fears in a relationship with a person who was just incapable of meeting them, which is not his fault. He literally is incapable of it.
So obviously your therapist was one of these anchors.
Mm-hmm.
So where else do you find these anchors?
Such a good question, because I'm writing another book about this now, and I work with clients, and I have like a couple angels, I call them, in my life path that have just held space. And, you know, sometimes you can find them in an ACOA meeting. ACOA is adult children of alcoholic or dysfunctional homes, but I think that you can find sponsors there. And sometimes it's just a non-judgmental friend that listens, and maybe it's a family member, maybe it's an aunt, who knows? And you know, you want to kind of collect people that are capable of not fixing you, but really listening to you and being there for you. My therapist was definitely one, but I also had a friend who was older than me and is almost like a father figure who was very consistent in supporting me. And I think if you're listening, these people don't make you feel better. They're there for you so you could work through your own feelings. And I think the switch is, instead of craving the unavailable to fix you, you start to be with the pain with people who are available to hold you. And there's a very big shift that happens when you start to do that. And you get a little bit out of, quote unquote, like the addiction or the fantasy that someone is going to, you know, medicate that pain. And you start to work through that pain with people who have the capacity to really kind of stand by you.
Now, as another therapist, I have some idea what you mean by hold me, but I think you're going to have to spell it out. We don't actually physically, I mean, obviously it could sometimes be physically giving you a hug, but you mean something more than that. So if they're not going to make us feel better, what are they doing, and how do we recognize these angels?
Yeah, so that's such a great question, because I'm writing about holding space, and really what it is they're lending you their nervous system. And they're lending you their presence and using their window of tolerance to hold your dysregulation, right? It's co-regulation at its best. So they're there as a calm, stable presence while you're struggling. Their energy and their nervous system tells your system it's safe, it's safe, it's safe. And so, you know, more work might come up for you, more embedded trauma might come up for you, or they're able to kind of help regulate you and co-regulate you, because I'm a big believer that co-regulation leads to self-regulation, not the other way around. So these people are just holding space and being unconditionally, hopefully non-judgmental and present. And your system starts to recognize that. Actually, when that first started happening for me, it was actually terrifying, because I think it opens the window to vulnerability and really being seen.
How was it terrifying?
I think because I had to be more vulnerable. You know, I was so used to being in the helping role, and I've helped so many people in my life, and I'm so lucky. But I think, you know, when someone's holding space for you, more of your vulnerabilities pop up. And more of my embodied experiences started to surface. And I had to be with more and more parts of myself, because I had someone actually in front of me who was capable of meeting those parts.
And I think what is really difficult for people to understand and recognize, whether they're anxious or avoidant, is often we have parents where one of them is anxious and one of them is avoidant. So we've actually seen both of those patterns played out. You know, stereotypically, it's the avoidant man behind his newspaper and the anxious woman who's trying to get his attention. But obviously, it can play out in other ways as well.
That's such a good point. And I should have said that, like, we embed more than one pattern. We embed a lot of patterns. My mom was preoccupied and struggled with a little postpartum depression. And my dad was really avoidant because he struggled with substance abuse. So I have both patterns embedded inside of me. And many of us have, and we can have other patterns. It can be an aunt, it can be a teacher. We can embed so many patterns early on inside of us that can show up differently. And you could show up a little anxious in your romantic life and a little avoidant with your girlfriends, or, you know, it can just fluctuate depending on your earlier experiences. Yes, you're definitely not one type with one person.
I think that's important to remember. And you have another concept that I think is really useful, and that's the idea of little me, the learned ways you use to keep your parents connected to you.
Yeah. So little me, I use that in my book and I'm going to use it in my next one because our past is always present. And you study interpersonal neurobiology, and my mentor, Bonnie Badenoch, you know, I've learned so much about streams of information and basically how we're always being influenced by our past. So when we are feeling sensations or feeling into our body, if we can start to reframe it as a younger part of ourselves as being awakened rather than triggered, we can start healing and holding things differently. And so I had to come up with a word. You know, inner child work has been around forever, but I came up with little me, and it's worked. And I have a lot of little me's in me, and they show up every once in a while when they're scared or joyful, or it's not just negative, you know? And that is actually true. Like, it's not some woo-woo. It's actually the science of how we embed and store memory and how those parts stay with us throughout our lifetime.
And when little me is triggered, there can be some common protest behavior. So I'm going to take you through a couple of them, and perhaps you can expand on them so we understand them. So one of the protest behaviors can be empty threats.
Yeah, I mean, so here's the thing about all the protest behaviors. They all make sense, and they're all born of fear of loss of connection. Fight flight is a hairline trigger when we feel threatened of loss of connection. So we will do a lot of behaviors that look, but we can judge ourselves from the outside. But when you really understand the nature of what we want to do to stay in connection, or how desperate we are to stay in connection, we will up the ante and turn the volume up when we're terrified.
So an empty threat could be something like, if you don't, I'm leaving, or we need to get a divorce, when you don't really mean it.
Yeah, you're turning up the volume and you're saying, hey, I'm in a lot of pain. And I got to up the ante because you're not paying attention.
The next one is angry blaming. That's going to get them back, isn't it?
Yeah, most of the time when someone's angry blaming, they're hurting a lot inside.
And then we have internet stalking.
There's a sense of limerence or fear that you might lose someone, their jealousy, insecure issues. If you had any abandonment or you grew up in a home where there was cheating or anything, you can be scared or feel threatened by anything on the external world if you don't have that inner sense of security and you have that fear that something's going to be taken away from you. So you could become obsessed with the other person.
And this is one that surprised me, cheating.
Cheating is definitely a way in which an anxious person might want to get attention or sabotage their relationship because they're not getting what they need.
So if you're doing some of these behaviors, often sort of almost they take you over, they unconsciously come to the surface and suddenly you're doing it, and none of them are going to help. How do you row back from them?
First, find compassion and start to understand what the root is and the fear and the terror is and the abandonment is that causes you to do them in the first place. Maybe have someone help hold that. It's always getting back to the root, and it's always making sense of our behaviors. It's never about judging these behaviors. It's about understanding that they're there for good reason, because it's probably terrifying you. Something's terrifying you deep within, and we want to get to that.
Any sort of tips for something that can sort of bring us out of it? Because that's very what you've just given us is very much a long-term solution.
I think when you're awakened, I like to say awakened rather than triggered, because if we Right. think about little me, that's really what's going on. Our automatic nervous system is really out of our control, but the one thing that is in our control is our respiratory system. So if you can extend your exhales and start to try to slow your system down, if not, if you can co-regulate, and what I mean is call a friend and not pour more gasoline on the story, but just get your nervous system to calm down. Remember, your thoughts follow your nervous system. So starting to recognize you're in fight or flight, or you're activated and you need to get calm. And what are the things you can get calm that aren't around your partner, because they might not be available in that moment, right? The partner is available, obviously, that's great. But if not, there are other ways to kind of start to get your system to get tricked back into safety. And one of them is extending your exhales and your respiratory system, and you might, you know, get back into a ventral state.
And I like the idea of contacting a friend or doing something that actually makes you feel good. It doesn't mean that you're actually avoiding the problem. You're just actually getting your nervous system calmed down enough to be able to do something that's going to be productive.
As long as you're contacting a friend who isn't going to get angry for you, pour more gasoline on it, a friend that's like, okay, just like helping you calm down without getting into the specifics. Because if you contact a friend or a family member that doesn't like your partner or doesn't like the other person, you're just escalating it more. So the whole goal is, how do I get myself to calm down without, and it's so, we all do it. It's so easy to want to talk crap, right? When we're upset. But really, it's about getting yourself out of that state back into like a better place mentally. And so you want to make sure whoever you're calling is supporting the relationship and supporting your nervous system without adding more gas to the fire.
You talk about finding some inner resources as well. You name a couple of them, the inner protector and the inner nurturer. So tell us about those.
So your inner protectors are actually protecting you from pain. Ironically, sometimes they cause you more pain, right? They can be like eating too much or a critical voice in there or trying to tell you have to be perfect or blaming yourself. They all believe that if you do X, Y, and Z, you will save yourself from pain. Starting to label them as protectors, welcoming them, understanding how you develop them, making sense of why they're there. The more healing you have, the less need of them you will need. And your inner nurturers are the secure and warm experiences that you have either in the past or currently of people. And so when you think of inner security and you think of a baby, they internalize security, right? And so we're constantly internalizing each other. So when we think about someone who really cares and genuinely has our best interest at heart, whether the past, present, or even future, and we close our eyes and we can access their energy, and that's like quantum physics, right? And we can imagine them near us and hopefully flood our system with the feelings of support and love, we can kind of take ourselves to a better place by internalizing the right support of others.
Personally, I was more avoidant than anxious. I've sort of changed because I learned to actually start negotiating. It was perfectly possible to say, look, actually, I need some time out. I'm just going to go for a walk sort of kind of thing rather than just sort of mentally disappearing, which if you can talk about these things, it gets much easier. What did you find that helped you move forward? What are the particular tools that you've learned that you use on a regular basis?
People who are anxiously attached, I think, struggle with control. And I one of the things is that you can't control another person's behavior and getting out of the dynamic of, and I will try everything that we tried when we're small. We'll fight, we'll collapse, we'll run towards, we'll run away. But like just coming to this conclusion that another person's behavior has nothing to do with me. Like I was with someone where their behavior was like, it was really out there. And I was like, they're in so much fear that this is what their behavior is doing and trying not to personalize it. And then constantly surrendering the control of trying to get someone to do something that seems pretty, you know, mundane or whatever, but just letting go. I mean, I think for anxious people, we lose ourselves a lot in relationships, and letting go of other people's behaviors is something that we're constantly working on.
So the main task is actually going inwards rather than being so outwardly focused.
Yeah, I think that huge shift in conscious awareness comes when we do go inwards. And I think a good therapist or coach will start to help you see your current dynamic and start to connect it to an earlier space and time. So you can see that your person is bringing up earlier things. And then you start to get like dual awareness and you start to understand there's so much more that meets the eye that's being activated and showing up now. So it's an opportunity for healing. Yeah, we get out of, you know, the blame game and total projection.
And how does having children impact all of this?
I actually think our attachment system gets kind of played out with our children as well. I always think that there are some people who can ignore the fact that they have children and just go through the emotions, but many people get awakened through their children. and they can re-experience some of their early wounds in a positive way and do some deep healing because they have these children in front of them and they can bring out the child inside of us and it can shift your perspective completely.
Do you have children?
I was a stepmom for a long period of time and they had a very, very positive effect on me. I became very attached to them. But like, I think because of my trauma and attachment stuff, I never really wanted my own kids. It's not something I inherently desired. I would now if I was younger and my life was different, but they taught me why people have kids and they were wonderful. And I got very attached to them and I grew a lot from that experience. And I would be a stepmom again. I think that's a wonderful role to learn and to provide in that space. I don't think you have to be a biological mother to like really love that role. But again, that took time for me with them. And I'm very grateful that for that experience that I had.
Because now when I'm working with people who are anxiously attached, there's a bit of a tendency to say, right, now I've learned this. I'm not going to go for avoidant people in the future. I'm going to go off and I'm going to find a secure person. Now, that sort of is all very well on the surface. Why might that be a problem?
Well, the pattern lives inside of you. And even if you, if you find a secure, more secure person, that's great. That just means your anxious stuff that comes up will probably be easier to work through. Not that your anxious stuff that comes up will go away. So yeah, the book Attached kind of says that, but the truth is your patterns are your patterns and they're going to play out again. It's just, if you find a more secure person, you might have a better chance of resolving more. And I think that we're attracted to people energetically that are wounded at our same developmental place. And so if you don't heal, the likelihood of you attracting a more secure person, who am I to say you can't, but you're more likely to keep attracting people that have a charge that's similar to what's familiar for you so you can continue healing. So it's all about always trying to constantly heal.
Because what I used to sometimes see was people who would flip-flop between the two things. They would find somebody they really were passionate about and be anxious. And then they'd say, no, I'm going to go for a sensible person next time. And they would go for somebody they weren't really very interested in, but they made sense on paper and would be sort of avoidant. And generally the other person would be anxious. And then they would say, oh, well, that doesn't work. And then they go back to somebody they're really attracted to and they flip-flop between those two things. Do you see that too?
Yeah, I think our subconscious always looks for, well, if that didn't work, let me try this. You know, and like that's an illusion in some ways. And also being incredibly human. Like I've noticed people in my life, you know, will go for one type and then eventually go for a completely different type, thinking, oh, this will be the solution because it's the opposite of what I have. And then, you know, years later or whatever, realize that the core wounds and the adaptive strategies still live inside of them. And so we can change the external world, but chances are our internal world will always kind of find a way to show up and repeat itself until we heal it.
And how do you decide if you should leave this relationship or give it one last try? Because you're saying these patterns are really deeply established.
Yeah, I think getting professional help helps a lot. Like I recently was working with this couple and I adore them. And I remember meeting with the guy and I was like, I don't know if he's going to be able to do Imago. That's the type of therapy I do. I do couples counseling. And they were pretty disconnected. She was pretty anxious. He was pretty avoidant. And I was like, oh, this might not work. And I started doing session with them and they both really, really responded. And recently they both admitted that they were both unavailable. Even a very anxious person can be emotionally very unavailable. And so just in a few sessions, being able to move the needle gave them enough hope. So I think, you know, when you have another professional in the room who really understands and knows what they're doing, it can help create the awareness to hopefully move through this together. Because I think getting a new partner is not really always the best solution. Sometimes it is the right thing to do. And the more healing that you do, the more clarity around what is right for you should come. But if there's an opportunity for you and your partner to do some couples work and there's two willing partners, it's a beautiful opportunity to heal whether you stay together or not, heal those patterns so you don't bring, or those wounds, you don't bring them into your next relationship.
Well, we're going to look in detail at one particular relationship from a letter that's been written in to me in just a moment.
The Meaningful Life with Andrew G. Marshall. Please follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook, and visit our website, andrewgmarshall.com/podcast, where you can join our supporters club and unlock bonus material and other benefits.
If you'd like to participate in the program, you can go to my website, andrewgmarshall.com/podcast. You'll find a form there, which is called Participate in the Program. Always interesting to get ideas for future programs as well. I cheated on my husband 2 months ago. It was a one-night stand. I did know the man, but I had no intention of it going any further. I couldn't live with myself, and I confessed 2 days later. My husband was shocked and thought we were doing okay and didn't see it coming. We have a very up and down relationship with some major communication issues. I've been struggling to understand how I could cause all this heartache without thinking things through beforehand. The more I think about it, I believe my actions were a cry for help, and I started seeing a psychologist. I asked my husband to come with me to a marriage counsellor, but he says there's no point, that we are over. But it's been 2 months. We're still living together with our 5-year-old. I want to work on our issues because I believe we can get back to the happy old us. He doesn't know how to trust me again. I've told him I would never do it again. I wouldn't want to cause this hurt or put anyone through this again. He says he still loves me, but it's over. I'm just trying to give him space. It's all very confusing. I really never thought I was capable of doing this. So there feels a real push and pull here. What are your thoughts, Jessica?
Yeah, I mean, that's a tough one. I think that the relational problems or conflicts were there well before she did that behavior. And I would say that was a behavior born of something deeper going on inside of her, an unhappiness that has not been addressed in her marriage, and not a reflection of her wanting to leave her marriage, but more of a behavior of sabotage or attention or a cry for help. I think that if you're listening and you go and you do some therapy and you get to the core of what's underneath that behavior and maybe explain that to your husband and you invite your husband in to say, hey, we had problems way before this. This is the symptom of like so many underlying things that we have left unaddressed. Let's try to address those things together and heal past the betrayal. I mean, and healing is absolutely possible. And if she gets to the core of what she was, you know, in Imago, she got to the core of that and explained it. It doesn't make the behavior okay, but he starts to understand deeper levels of what's going on inside of her. But again, he also has to be a willing participant. And if you're listening and he's not a willing participant, I suggest that you go to therapy, a good therapist, and you get to the core of what was going on for you before you acted out. And understand the acting out was just a symptom of some deeply rooted stuff that was there and wasn't getting resolved.
So a lot of compassion for yourself rather than beating yourself up to start off with.
Absolutely.
The next thing I would say is it's very easy to get caught up in the drama of the moment. You know, are we going to stay together? Are we not going to stay together? Talking about all of that. And that uses up a lot of emotional energy. Whereas I think what we're actually both of us saying is she needs to go deeper. If he's not available, she can get some help and go deep and understand about that cry for help. But that's quite difficult to do if you're forever worried about what's going to happen at the moment. And how does she stop worrying about, you know, is he going to be here in 2 months' time, and focus on what can I do to find myself a sense of safety within?
Yeah, I mean, that's really hard because her attachment is not secure at this moment. But if he's not going to be here at 2 months' time, there's an opportunity to hold that fear and abandonment and possibly link it to earlier times. You know, so start where you're at. And so she's not ready to figure out why she acted out. She might be ready to go to this tremendous amount of fear that he might leave. Is that something I experienced before? And where do I experience that in my body? And let's go there, really hold it with my therapist and see if there's some deep abandonment wounds connected to this feeling of uncertainty.
Because the fact that he's still there and hasn't left suggests that he might be doing some of the protest behavior we were talking about, the sort of empty threats, rather than actually something that he really wants to carry through.
Absolutely. I mean, and he probably, you know, is in an ambivalent state of pain. I don't want to run towards her, but I'm not ready to leave her. And I'm just really hurting. So I'm going to say, you know, what brings me relief is maybe hurting her back or, you know, ending the relationship. We don't know. I mean, we really would need to talk to the couple.
But the reason it's confusing is because a lot of this is happening on an unconscious level.
Well, I mean, 50% of it or 80%. Yeah, there's a lot happening on an unconscious level, right? Yeah, for sure. And, you know, what's the hardest is the willingness. You know, he at this time, he's protesting he won't get help with her. So I would suggest that she gets help alone with the real hope that eventually he's open to understanding what led up to this and looking at his parts as well. Not just her behavior was awful at the end. And let's discount, how did we get here?
That's really difficult to say to your partner, isn't it? Because then it comes across as blaming the victim. And I'm putting air quotes up there at the time.
Yeah, I mean, her behavior is hurtful and harmful, and I'm not discounting cheating. I mean, that's horrible. I've been on that. I've been on the receiving end of that. But, you know, a relationship takes two. And I think that other than take that aside, you need to start looking at how did we end up here together.
So thank you for that. I hope that was helpful. And as I say, if you'd like to write into us, the details are at www.andrewgmarshall.com/podcasts. I think we need to sort of move to a note of optimism, because I think it is really important to say that although these lessons might have started young, you're not doomed to keep on dealing with it to the end of your life.
Yeah. So no, totally. And it is work to heal. I'm not going to lie. Like, healing is a process, but due to neuroplasticity and what we really understand about the brain and our inherent wisdom in our body, that we are going to lean towards safe, warm connections, and the desire to heal will point us in the right direction. And I can say that healing, once you heal, there's a forever healing. So there's a forever deepening. It doesn't end. But getting through the embedded trauma or the earlier wounding, that does end at a certain point. And you do get to the other side. It is hard in the middle, but we do understand a lot around neuroplasticity now and healing. And healing is very possible. And we're designed to go towards healing relationships and to seek out healing when we get a taste of safety in that kind of context.
And if you were going to leave anxiously attached people with one thought, what would it be?
You're so not alone. That's an early ego state that, you know, that little you have, and it comes up for you periodically, the abandonment and the alone, and healing that means when you get to the other side, you feel interconnected with everything. And so just when you get to those lonely places, reach out for support and just know that you're not alone.
Excellent. Well, we're going to continue the conversation in a moment with when does anxious attachment become love addiction or codependency? We'll be talking about that in the bonus material in a moment. And if you'd like to hear that, I'll give you the details in a moment. But before we finish the main podcast, Jessica, as a witness on The Meaningful Life, I need to ask you, what makes your life meaningful?
Wow. My work, creating another book, so helping people on a deep level. And connection, heartfelt, genuine connection that I've been able to cultivate in my life, my anchors, as I would call them. And I guess the mundane, like just the simple things in life that bring me so much meaning. I walk my dog every morning. I meditate. I live in this most beautiful space ever. I'm so full of gratitude for just, I've been through so much healing. And I'm not saying this, I'm saying I've reached a place of contentment for myself and my world, and how lucky I am to help individuals become more embodied how lucky I am to express my own personal stories and my clinical expertise to a very large audience. And I just feel so lucky in this lifetime that I get to help and receive warm relationships on the other side.
If you want to hear the bonus material, you can subscribe directly via Apple or Spotify. If you want to become a supporter of The Meaningful Life and unlock the bonus material this way, here are the details.
You've been listening to The Meaningful Life with Andrew G. Marshall. You can follow Andrew on Twitter, like him on Facebook, and please leave a review wherever you consume your podcasts. Making, editing, and distributing The Meaningful Life comes with substantial costs, and we'd like to ask for your help. Visit our website, andrewgmarshall.com/podcast, where you can join our supporters club and unlock bonus material for every program, send in a letter to be discussed by Andrew and his guests, and join a community of other people seeking to make their life meaningful. At the gold level, you get even more benefits. Production of The Meaningful Life with Andrew G. Marshall is by Michael Dooney. Social media by Madeleine Healy. Sound engineering and theme tune by Sebastian de la Luz Mendoza. And I'm Susie Kolick. Please tell your friends and spread the word. Thank you.